Comey says there's no doubt of a Russian hack. Jeff Sessions tries a new tack. And yours truly gets a new back. Lordy, I hope there are tapes of the political junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. James Comey says President Trump lied about him and the FBI. Trump says that Comey lied about their private conversations.
It does betoken, I think, the change in civility and the change in atmosphere that we're in Washington. This was highly unusual. It's unimaginable, really, for most of us, using those kinds of words about each other in public.
Plus, there are plenty of events that define a presidency, including TV shows.
24 perfectly captures the fears we had during the Bush years. I think it has a lot of left-leaning paranoia in it that tends to get written out because it was an endorsement of some of the Bush administration's worst foreign policy ideas.
And we remember Tim Russert, the late Meet the Press moderator, who was tough on polls from both parties, never letting anyone get away with anything.
Tim had this sort of equal opportunity toughness about him. And so he really tried to play kind of that devil's advocate, but do it in a way that was tough but fair and civil.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And like to you, and mean to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 183 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The appearance of former FBI Director James Comey last week before the Senate Intelligence Committee lived up to its billing as a congressional hearing for the ages. It was, as advertised, must-see TV. The specter of Comey accusing the President of the United States of being a liar was pretty astonishing. But you kind of knew it would come down to this, after all the signs of Russian interference and allegations of Trump campaign collusion and the resignation of Michael Flynn and the firing of James Comey and the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel. Ron Elving is a senior correspondent and editor for NPR and is here to give us his take on not only what Comey said, but what it means and what it could lead to. Lordy, Ron, help us out here.
Lordy, I hope there are tapes, Ken.
Well, we are recording this, and I think the American public needs to know that we are recording this on Monday, a day before Jeff Sessions appears before the same committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, on Tuesday in open session, because Ken Rudin, who happens to be the president and vice president and chairman and secretary and treasurer of the Political Junkie, is having back surgery this week. So Monday's the only time I could do this, Ron.
I understand. You know, there's a really interesting backstory behind all that.
Well, actually, my girlfriend wrote a song about this. Did you know that?
No.
My boyfriend's back? Yeah, she wrote a whole song about that. And we'll play it later because it's a very funny joke. Wait.
Lordy,
Ron,
I hope there aren't tapes.
Ron, did you? Yeah, I hope there are no tapes of this conversation. So we're doing this on a Monday, and of course, I was in the car for many hours on Thursday, and so this is the first hearing I could ever remember listening to it. And of course, we always talk about the beauty of radio, and I never understood it as well as I did on Thursday, because everything I heard was on the radio. I didn't see Comey's face or Burr or Warner or any of the senators. It was really fascinating being in this car and listening to the sounds and listening to some of the statements he made, which sounded pretty consequential.
Well, Ken, if you're going to be limited to only one way of witnessing or experiencing a particular hearing, and if it's going to be just audio, this was a good one because there was not that much visual to it. There were some facial expression moments, but the words were the focus all the way through. And to hear, as you said, James Comey using the word lies, the word lying, the word liar, this was highly unusual. It's unimaginable, really, for most of us, that ever any president in the past, any FBI director in the past, would actually be using those kinds of words about each other in public, on an official record. That kind of recrimination, can you imagine that going on between LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover? I mean, they may have despised each other, but they never would have allowed any of that to show in public. So that part was extraordinary.
Well, we keep talking about the significance of the hearing and what we heard. Let's hear that part right now.
And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple.
You know, I mean, again, you know that we've heard the Trump and Comey versions of the truth for weeks now, but to hear the former director of the FBI say that the president said lies, I think the obvious takeaway is either Comey is lying or the president of the United States is lying, and people can make up their own minds, but one of them is lying. And that's a word you don't throw, it's not easy to throw out there.
That's right, and it does betoken, I think, the change in civility and the change in atmosphere that we're in Washington, not only in the Trump era, but in recent years, the last 10, 20 years, the partisanship has certainly increased. But here you have a personal level of recrimination that is highly unusual, remembering that these are both Republicans we're talking about, the president and the FBI director. While he was appointed by Barack Obama, he was and is a Republican and had served in the George W. Bush administration and has essentially a Republican circle of friends and associates. So this is not strictly partisanship. This is a different kind of incivility. But there's one other thing that I think might have been somewhat lost prior to this hearing, and maybe regained at least in part in this hearing, and that was the, quote, very big deal that James Comey referred to. The more than 1,000 intrusions that he said the Russians had attempted to make with government agencies, non-government agencies, all kinds of people who were concerned in the election in 2016, were messed with by the Russian cyber hackers, and that is, as James Comey said, a very big deal. We shouldn't lose track of the underlying offense here, what is initializing all of these hearings and all of this investigation.
And he was asked, Comey was asked whether there's any doubt in his mind that Russia did these intrusions, and he said there's no doubt in my mind whatsoever.
And that is significant because one of the first defenses that the Trump administration, or pushback that we've seen from the Trump administration, was to say that the whole thing was a hoax. That was a word that the president himself used in his tweets, and to suggest that this was all an imaginary kind of a concern that the Democrats had generated, essentially invented, to explain an otherwise inexplicable loss to Donald Trump. It was just too hard for the Democrats to take, and so they had come up with this excuse.
I also thought that the senators, the lawmakers on the Intelligence Committee, for the most part, handled themselves pretty well. I mean, we saw what was going on, certainly in the House, with Devin Nunes and the accusations that he was doing the Trump's bidding on the House Intelligence Committee. And, you know, when you go back to, you think of how both parties came together in some ways during the Sam Ervin Watergate Committee in 73, and even around Contra, that both sides seemed to be on the same side, both parties seemed to be on the same side. It seemed like both Democrats and Republicans were respectful of the process, were not dismissive of it, certainly not the way the RNC has sent out their talking points and the way Eric Trump and others would tweet about what these people are doing. They seem much more serious about the job they had to do.
And generally speaking, they were respectful of James Comey. They did not take part in trashing him the way a lot of Trump's other surrogates have done, both before the hearing and during the hearing and after the hearing, including the president himself, who went on Twitter on Friday to call James Comey a liar. That kind of treatment of the former FBI director, a man of rather sterling reputation, who heretofore has primarily angered Democrats for the way he handled Hillary Clinton's email controversy last year, and has, generally speaking, had the respect of both parties, as you say, they were not really eager to take him on in a personal reputation kind of way. Now, we'll see whether or not that lasts as we go forward, but I was struck by some of the toughest people on the committee, people like Tom Cotton, Nixon, who is a Harvard Law School product, went rather easy on him, did not interrogate him closely, did not suggest that they were having trouble believing him. And when a couple of the senators, like John Cornyn from Texas and then John McCain from Arizona, tried to suggest that perhaps there was a double standard here, that James Comey had been tougher on Donald Trump than he was on Hillary Clinton, he turned that around on them very quickly and made it sound as though really the offenses that he was describing, and particularly with respect to obstruction of justice, although he did not himself use that phrase, were just more serious, and that really was not something the Republicans wanted to hear.
Well, I want to get to McCain in a second. When I was listening to McCain question Comey, I really literally almost drove off the road because I couldn't believe how he was conflating what seemed to be two completely different investigations. But let me just go stick with Richard Burr for a second because, you know, he's the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He's a conservative Republican. He was basically a Trump surrogate during the campaign. There were a lot of Democrats who felt that he could not be fair, but he seems to be working with the ranking Democrat, the co-chairman Mark Warner, very well. And two, he was pretty complimentary of Comey during his questioning.
Jim, several of us on this committee have had the opportunity to work with you since you walked in the door. I want to say personally, on behalf of all the committee members, we're grateful to you for your service to your country, not just in the capacity as FBI director, but as prosecutor, and more importantly, being somebody that loves this country enough to tell it like it is.
And Ron, that was the Republican chairman of the committee.
Yes, and when he says someone who has told it like it is, that it comes very close to endorsing James Comey's version of events, which, as we know, is quite totally at odds with that of the president himself. So this would tend to indicate that Burr is at least open to that version of events, and that would be bad news, I would think, from the standpoint of the president.
Before I talk a little more about Comey's testimony, I want to know what you think about him in general. You've read everything between a straight shooter to a self-righteous. He's shrewd. He's manipulative. He's certainly a survivor. How do you see him?
It's difficult to see why the White House chose to call him a showboater. There have been occasions when he has given a news conference, and by far the most famous of them was the one that he gave when he announced that he was not going to recommend that Hillary Clinton be charged with actual crimes for her handling of sensitive and national security sensitive documents through email. And this is the famous use of her personal server. And this was by many felt to be a criminal mishandling of this material, because they alleged at least that some of it was classified and known to be classified at the time that she was using her personal server to convey these messages back and forth. That was a determination that he and most legal experts made to be subcriminal. It was careless, it was reckless, said James Comey, but it wasn't criminal. And that was a blow to a lot of people who hoped that she could be knocked right out of the presidential box, right out of the election, by some sort of indictment. Way back about a year ago, when James Comey was announcing what he and the rest of the FBI had concluded. Now, the reason for that news conference, I think, has been quite clear. He's made it quite clear on a number of occasions that he felt he had to do that to explain the difference between what he saw as poor policy and something that was actually a criminal act. And he felt he had to do that because the Attorney General at the time, Loretta Lynch, had to step back even further than usual from this investigation after the unfortunate incident of Bill Clinton getting on her airplane on a tarmac in Phoenix, Arizona, and chatting her up. And even if we accept Clinton's explanation that it was totally a chance meeting and that they only talked about their grandchildren, it just looked terrible at that particular moment in the investigation of Bill Clinton's wife, Hillary, and the potential for the blow-up of her entire presidential campaign.
But I think also that I think that Comey was tougher on Lynch than I expected when he made a point of saying over and over again that Lynch was instructing the Bureau to call it a matter, not an investigation. And so it seemed like, I mean, if Republicans got any joy out of this hearing on Thursday at all, it seemed like hearing a lot of Republicans say is that maybe Loretta Lynch should be investigated for the way she handled the Hillary Clinton investigation. My only point is that we're talking about Comey as a straight shooter. He's taking on not only the president of the United States, a Republican, but the former attorney general of the United States, Loretta Lynch, a Democrat. And an equal opportunity basher, or whatever you want to call him.
You could say that, and in a sense, that should be a way of proving one's bona fides as an independent. Unfortunately, the way things actually work in Washington, oftentimes being an equal opportunity critic or basher, as you say, just means that you wind up with no friends at all.
Obviously, everybody is more than willing to draw parallels to 1973 and 1974, and of course, the ultimate takedown of Richard Nixon was the release of those tapes when Donald Trump tweeted not that long ago. He said, you know, Comey better not be telling us any lies because, you know, hopefully there are no tapes involved. And everybody suddenly wondered whether there are tapes. And of course, if James Comey is telling the truth, what I heard from James Comey on Thursday, that he would be very happy if there were tapes.
Well, the Secret Service has already responded to a Freedom of Information Act request by saying that they no longer maintain a taping system in the White House the way that they did in the Nixon era when those famous Watergate tapes were produced, or for that matter, in the preceding Kennedy era when John F. Kennedy set up a taping system in the White House. And the first such system that was set up in the White House goes all the way back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So it wasn't something that Nixon invented, but it was something that by Nixon's time was being administered by the Secret Service. And they have made it clear they're not in that business anymore. So we don't know if there are tapes, but we know at least that the Secret Service was not responsible for them.
I was actually, when you were going back to FDR, I was afraid you were going back to Lincoln because you keep referring to Abraham Lincoln in our podcast for some reason.
I know, but that's just an odd predilection that I have to bring up Abraham Lincoln whenever I possibly can, and at times when it makes absolutely no sense at all.
Because it was his face.
His face, the two halves of his face didn't match. He was asymmetrical.
Now I understand that joke. Okay. In the scheme of things, I mean, ultimately, what I'm about to talk about now is really more of a sideshow, but I referred earlier to John McCain's questioning of James Comey, and I'm pointing at that only because it just stunned me. I'd like to play a little bit of this McCain tape and talk about it a little bit.
Tell me the difference between your conclusion as far as former Secretary Clinton is concerned and Mr. Trump.
The Clinton investigation was a completed investigation that the FBI had been deeply involved in, and so I had an opportunity to understand all the facts and apply those facts against the law as I understood them. This investigation was underway, still going when I was fired, so it's nowhere near in the same place. At least it wasn't when I was...
But it's still ongoing.
Correct. So far as I know, it was when I left.
That investigation was going on. This investigation is going on. You reached separate conclusions.
No, that one was done.
Investigation of any involvement of Secretary Clinton or any of her associates is completed.
Yes, as of July the 5th, the FBI completed its investigative work, and that's what I was announcing, what we had done and what we had found.
Well, at least in the minds of this member, there's a whole lot of questions remaining about what went on, particularly considering the fact that, as you mentioned, it's a, quote, big deal as to what went on during the campaign.
I'm usually very respectful of John McCain, but it sounded to me, and again, I'm sitting in the car, but it sounded to me like he was completely confusing two different investigations.
It was not entirely clear what Senator McCain was thinking. And the very next day, he and his staff put out a tweet in which he apologized for his appearance or the nature of the question that he asked and said he'd been staying up too late watching Arizona Diamondback games at night. Okay. The senator did seem to be having trouble following the line of response that he was getting from James Comey after asking the question. He seemed to be suggesting that somehow or another there were reasons to be looking at collusion between Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016 and the Russian interference in that 2016 election. He didn't put forward any evidence of that, but what he seemed to be suggesting was that her failures with respect to the personal server that she used for her email were also part of the whole question of 2016 perfidies and bad behavior, and that there should have been an equal standard between what was expected of her, what standard she was held to, and what Donald Trump is now being asked to answer for. I think that's what he was trying to say, but it was not entirely clear. He seemed to be following up on a question asked earlier by John Cornyn, the senator from Texas, that suggested that sauce for the goose should be sauce for the gander, and if Hillary Clinton got kind of a pass for some of the things that she did that were sloppy, maybe it did not make sense to be all that much tougher on Donald Trump and his campaign.
First of all, Comey at one point actually had to interrupt McCain, said, I'm really not sure what your question is. To me, at least, it just felt, listening to him, that he was confusing two different investigations, and it just felt like I felt like I was sharing Comey's confusion at the whole thing. Another thing that also surprised me, too, was Paul Ryan's reaction that Trump is new at this. Now, what? That's the Speaker of the House's response to the hearings, that, well, Trump is new at this?
There was a sense among Republicans that they were almost desperate to think of a more benign explanation for some of the things the president had reportedly said to James Comey, such as, I hope you can let this go, in reference to the Michael Flynn investigation. Maybe he meant something other than to discourage the continuation of that investigation, which would be obstruction of justice. So let's think of it as just maybe a moment at which the president was shrugging his shoulders and going, gee, Mike Flynn's such a nice guy. I hope it all comes out all right for him, and that there were no winks and no nudges, at that particular moment. So Paul Ryan seemed really interested in finding some way to construe what the president had said or to excuse it. But, you know, the idea of painting Donald Trump as some kind of naive just because he hasn't been in government for the last 30 or 40 years, he has been involved in a pretty tough business in New York in real estate. He has been involved in a lot of high-profile lawsuits. He knows perfectly well that what you say to an investigator or a prosecutor or an attorney who is questioning you in the dock has to be very carefully thought about and can be seen, well, it can be seen in an unfriendly light.
Well, I just saw a Quinnipiac poll that had Trump approval at 34%. Now, I don't know what's more remarkable, that it's that low or that 81% of the Republican Party is still on his side, but 34% is, I mean, that's Nixon after 6 years, or that's Carter after 4 years. But this is, we're talking about a couple of months for Trump.
Also troubling, I think, for the White House, and there are some indications that they are aware of this and troubled by it, is the decrease in the number of people who strongly approve. They have had a large number, 30% type number of strongly approved. Now that number you're referring to from Quinnipiac would combine strongly approve and somewhat approve. If the strongly approved number deteriorates drastically, and I've seen one set of numbers where it's down by about a third, that may be even more damaging, that may be even more troubling for the White House than the overall drop in their approval. And we should say there are some polls that still show him in the high 30s or up around 40 or a little over 40. Those are low numbers for a president in his first few months, but it certainly would be better than 34. The Quinnipiac poll has kind of defined the low end of the range for Trump's polls up to now. It's also significant that the strongly disapproved number is about twice the size of the strongly approved number, or approaches that level. That's extraordinary, and certainly extraordinary for this early in a presidency, and certainly extraordinary this early in a presidency when many things in the country are going pretty well. The economy seems to be back on track. Unemployment is down almost to 4%. We have a lot of growth happening, and there are a lot of good indicators that people should be happy. But clearly, some of what's been going on in Washington is not making everyone happy.
Well, I was going to say that later this week, I'm going to be under anesthesia for several hours. I know a lot of people who wish they were under anesthesia for the last 4 months. But let me ask you one more thing, but before we go, and there's no way to predict, but June 20th, next Tuesday, is that big election, Georgia's 6th Congressional District. No Democrat has won it since 1976. It's Tom Price's old district. It's Newt Gingrich's old district. John Ossoff, in the latest poll I saw, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, had the Democrat up. I mean, this is obviously going to be seen as a referendum on Donald Trump, even though Ossoff is not running an outwardly anti-Trump campaign the way the Democrats did this week in Virginia. But what do you think is going to happen?
Well, it's already phenomenally expensive, many millions of dollars being raised and spent on this race. And as you say, it's being treated as a surrogate contest between Donald Trump and all of his enemies. This is a district that the Democrats have some standing in. There are moderate Republicans in this district. It's not a dyed-in-the-wool Trump district, but it is one that one would expect, given Tom Price's easy re-elections there, one would expect him to be succeeded by a Republican. And down the road, maybe after this special election, even if Ossoff should win, it probably will revert to Republican form in time. It's a Republican district. That having been said, if Ossoff wins, it's going to be seized upon, and it might actually begin to panic some Republican members of the House and Senate. I wouldn't go so far as to predict that. I also don't feel confident that he will win by the kind of percentage or margin that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's poll would suggest. This race will tighten up further, and in all likelihood, in the end, the turnout of Republicans is just more reliable than it is among Democrats. So my suspicion is, in the long run, Karen Handel probably will still prevail. But just the closeness of it and the prospect that it could go Democratic is already giving some misgivings and some mild feelings of fear to a lot of the Republicans in the House and Senate.
Well, let me leave you with three words. Richard Vanderveen. Do you remember that guy?
Could you give me those three words again, Ken?
Richard Vanderveen. He was the guy who won Gerald Ford's House seat in that special 74 election after Ford left. And John Murtha won that special House election in Pennsylvania in the spring of 74. I'm just saying that if Ossoff wins, and I don't know, I agree with you, I don't know what's going to happen at all. It obviously depends on who comes out. And Ossoff is spending a ton of money, but a lot of money is coming on Karen Handel's behalf as well. But I remember the spring of 74 when Murtha won that seat in Pennsylvania, when the Democrats and Richard Vanderveen won Gerald Ford seat in Michigan, and I said, uh-oh, I wonder what this means down the road. And you know that every Republican incumbent is going to be looking at Georgia 6 on Tuesday the 20th.
That's right. And of course, much has changed since 1974, and redistricting and gerrymandering has become a much greater fortress for incumbents than it was even then. And so many of these people would probably survive even in that kind of a tsunami that we saw in 1974, and they would be okay in a special election, or they would be okay, their district would be safely Republican for another round or two. But at the margin, just seeing their margins reduced and seeing the greater necessity to raise money and run a really vigorous campaign, that in and of itself would be frightening to a lot of the members. They don't want to see that happen. Plus, we'll have another redistricting after the 2020 census.
Ron Elving is a senior editor and correspondent for NPR. In a former life, he was my partner in crime on the It's All Politics podcast at NPR. And I'd like to announce something that if, I'm announcing this for the first time, that if something goes horribly wrong during this week's surgery, Ron Elving will be the new host of The Political Junkie. Ron, thanks so much for agreeing to do that.
Ken, I would say it's my pleasure, but I don't want to suggest that I want the job under those circumstances.
Ron, I have tapes saying you accepted it. Ron, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Ken. Always a pleasure.
By the way, since I'll be on the mend for the next couple of days or so, we're giving you some extra time to answer last week's trivia question, which is, who was the last female lieutenant governor who went on to be elected governor of her state? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
My boyfriend's back and you're gonna be in trouble.
Hey, la, my boyfriend's back.
When you see him coming, better cut out on the double.
Hey, la, my boyfriend's back.
You've been spreading lies that I was untrue. Look out now, 'cause he's coming after you.
If I asked you to name a TV show that reminds you of President Trump, that would be pretty easy. It would most likely be The Apprentice.
It's over. Don't you think it's over? I mean, not just these two guys, just everybody. They just don't seem to have it.
You are going to see great successes from the men.
Well, you know, I hope I'm going to really see great successes from you, Sam, but no longer with us. You're fired.
But with that show gone and the short-lived replacement, hosted for only one season by Arnold Schwarzenegger...
Connie, you're terminated. Hasta la vista, baby.
It remains to be seen what program will be identified with the Trump presidency. I suspect it won't be This Is Us. Several months ago, I spoke with Todd VanderWerf, Vox's critic at large, who wrote an article listing the past 10 presidencies prior to Donald Trump and the concurrent TV shows that defined them. I decided to invite Todd on the show to compare notes. Look, I love lists, and your compilation seems to me unusually inspired. When I think of decades, I'll think of presidents, or I'll think of TV shows, but I don't think I've ever linked them together.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of, I think, what spurred this in my mind when I was a teenager. I saw a lot of people talking about, I was a teenager in the 90s, so I saw a lot of people talking about, oh.
Wait. I just want to grasp that. You were a teenager. You know, I was a teenager in the 90s, too, but it was the 1890s. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was a teenager in the 1990s, I'm afraid. That was when I started to become aware of people talking about like the 80s as this show is so 80s, or this show is so, you know, Reagan era. And I was like, wait a second. Like, we define decades by two things that like run a long time during them, which is typically presidential administrations and TV shows. And I was like, surely there's got to be some cross-pollination there. And as I've sort of like, I don't want to say dug into this, but as I've sort of turned it over in my own head, I think I've convinced myself.
Well, I think you've convinced me too. I've looked at your list and I like it, but did you find yourself liking a president but not necessarily liking the TV show he was linked to, or vice versa?
You know, it's a weird thing. I would say I wasn't a huge George W. Bush fan, but I did really enjoy 24. Like I disagreed with so many of its politics, but I thought it was a really fun, really engaging, really action-packed show. And for its first four or five seasons, I watched that thing religiously. I mean, it fell apart in the end, but most TV shows do.
And so did the Bush administration.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with the present and go backwards. So what TV show did you have represented in the Obama years?
I ended up going with Parks and Recreation, the NBC comedy, because I feel like it is a great example of a show that started out about like government officials trying to do good. And by the end of the show, like certainly they've succeeded in some regards, but their townspeople are essentially revealed to just be barking loons who don't want to like listen to them at all. And it's this really great, it's sort of subtly optimistic, but also deeply cynical about how much politics can do. And that's a really weird blend of ideas. And to me, it sort of fits how people came to feel about the Obama years.
Well, this show is one of the few that really made me laugh out loud. I didn't always watch it, but when I did watch it, I laughed a lot. And I found this clip, which I like a lot. It's a scene where the Amy Poehler character is trying to talk about something to an old veteran of the city council who happens to have not changed his views on race in nearly 70 years.
Councilman, I'd like to talk to you about the Fun in the Sun bill, and I don't mean to rush you, but the vote is in an hour.
When I'm done eating, we'll talk. I've eaten the same lunch for 58 years. Caesar salad, extra dressing, extra croutons, and extra anchovies.
Councilman Milton was first elected as a city councilor in 1948 as a member of the Dixiecrat Party. Their platform, deintegrate baseball.
The secret is in the dressing. Try it. It's an aphrodisiac. You too, my strange foreign friend.
No, thank you.
Tom, eat some.
I'm not eating racist salad.
The more we eat, the faster we talk.
You can really taste the ignorance.
It's pronounced anchovies.
I mean, that's so perfect. One person is saying one thing and the other side has no idea what they're talking about. You mentioned earlier that the show you had for the George W. Bush administration is 24.
Yeah, and this is one of those things where when I was talking to people about the idea behind this article, like my editor and just people I know in my life, you know, there would be some argument about what should represent Obama. There would be some argument about like what should represent Clinton or Reagan. But you get to Bush and everybody said 24. I think it's just inescapable. And like normally when something is that set in stone, I like to try and find ways around it. I like to try and sort of have some wiggle room, but it you can't escape it. 24 perfectly captures sort of the fears we had during the Bush years. And then also like the waning of those fears, the time when we realized, you know, things that we had sacrificed in the name of those fears. And I don't think this is a perfect television show, but it's It's still very entertaining to watch. It's got some surprisingly nuanced politics for its reputation. I don't want to pretend it's like a hugely secretly liberal show or something, but I think it has a lot of left-leaning paranoia in it that tends to get written out because it was an endorsement of some of the Bush administration's worst foreign policy ideas.
But it did seem to capture the mood of the country after 9/11.
It absolutely did. You know, I think back to season two of that show, which is my favorite season. That's a season that essentially throws every major American fear of the 2000s into a blender and just goes nuts. It's great. Like, you will have, you know, oh, we're afraid of another terror attack, but you also have fear of being led into an unnecessary war by corporate interests. You have fear of elections being stolen by strange Byzantine procedures. It's a crazy, interesting season of TV.
When I think of that series, I think of Jack Bauer, the character portrayed by Kiefer Sutherland. He would do anything he can to stop terrorism. I'm going to play a clip of Jack Bauer trying to get information from a terrorist who killed Jack's girlfriend.
Start talking to me!
You want to know I killed your girlfriend? Yeah, I killed her. I killed your bitch! I did it!
Please, you've got to stop him. Please.
He needs answers, and he's going to get them.
I can use this. There's enough here. I don't need any more. Tell him I don't need any more, please.
You're not going anywhere.
So, Tana, who said torture doesn't work? It worked on 24.
What's interesting is if you look at, during the Bush administration, arguments made for torture by the government, by government officials, including Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, would cite like 24 as like precedent for why torture should be legal. And of course, that's crazy because it's a fictional television program where, you know, the writers are putting their thumb on the scales of what's going to happen. But like, it came up all the time. Just, this was a show that was beloved by the Bush administration. And that, you know, to a degree, I find that troubling. But at the same time, when you watch it, Kiefer Sutherland is so compelling and the action is so well done. It's sort of easy to let your objections slide.
Well, before Bush, we had 8 years of Bill Clinton.
Yes. And for me, maybe this is just because, again, this is when I was a teenager and this is the show I was watching at that time. But The X-Files for me just beautifully captures the Clinton era in a lot of like unexpected ways. You have sort of the obvious answer, which is a lot of people on the right sort of thought that Bill Clinton was out to get them, and they sort of spawned these conspiracy theories that gained great credence in sort of the early internet. And The X-Files was one of the first bubblings of those up to the surface of everything. But it's also a show very much about the post-Cold War era. It's about questioning all the things we did in order to beat the Soviet Union or to beat the Nazis in World War II. It's about taking a critical eye toward those things through the alien conspiracy storyline. And it's also a show about the end of local communities, about the rise of having this large national identity in the wake of mass media. So there are a lot of interesting themes that dovetail with the Clinton years. And I think Mulder and Scully are sort of the way to go here.
It's funny, back during that show, we weren't fighting illegal aliens like we are now. We're fighting aliens, just not from other countries.
That was sort of the idea of the show, is that there's, you know, these aliens invading through very covert schemes, and they're working with the United States government to do that. But actually, they're working with forces outside the government. It's in many ways an eerily prescient show in terms of how people think about these things. But in the end, the alien conspiracy didn't make much sense, as most conspiracy theories don't.
But as you point out, the paranoia we have about government, that exists today.
Yeah, you look at a lot of the paranoia about Democratic presidents, and so much of it has its roots in the Clinton years. And you look back to things like Ruby Ridge or the Oklahoma City bombing or even the standoff at Waco. These are things where certainly there are legitimate criticisms of how the Clinton administration handled those things. But these are things where there is this strain of paranoia on the right in that case, where there is this feeling that the government is, you know, constantly monitoring you, constantly is going to come and take your stuff. And the X-Files put a sci-fi sheen on that for sure. Like the reason you were being monitored was because the aliens were coming. But it did tap into those fears. And interesting way that I think people on both sides of the aisle could enjoy.
I saw on your list that for George H.W. Bush, you picked Roseanne. And I guess, you know, there was some theme about economic anxiety in that show and the Bush administration. But I'm more interested in Ronald Reagan. What was the show you picked for Reagan?
Family Ties, which actually ended up being tougher than I thought it would. But I ended up sort of thinking about one of the reasons I was hesitant to pick Family Ties is because it's a very sunny show. It doesn't really dig into some of the worst things that were happening in the 80s. And I like these shows to sort of hit both sides of everything. But then I thought about like how the 80s were a time for being sort of sunny and ignoring the bad things that were happening if they weren't happening to you. And Family Ties, to me, where every episode that has like a serious story, whether it's about alcoholism or the famous episode where Alex Keaton's friend dies, you know, it's all wrapped up by the end. I think that's sort of how we were thinking about those serious issues in the 80s. We wanted them to be confined to a half-hour episode of television.
You mentioned Alex Keaton. He was the character played by Michael J. Fox. He was a young Reagan in that show, right? I mean, we think of the 1960s and all the kids were liberals, but Alex Keaton was certainly not a liberal.
It's sort of a neat flip of All in the Family where the parents are the liberals and the kids are the conservatives.
Although, let me play this vintage scene. Here it is where Alex is talking to a class of, I think, 5 or 6 year olds, and he's talking about the evil of taxes.
Okay, now, we're going to need a business manager to help us avoid paying taxes. A tax is a terrible, hairy, liberal monster with big teeth. And the only thing that can stop the terrible tax monster is a Republican.
I kind of like that a lot. You know, on your list, I know you had Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, and they were spoofed by Saturday Night Live. And on our show, we've played a lot of those things. But I'm very interested in what you associate Richard Nixon with.
It's All in the Family, which to me feels a little bit like a cheat because it came on so late during his first term. But it was in development from 1968 on. It really, the Nixon era is when a lot of these political arguments people were having really boiled into living rooms. It wasn't that they hadn't been there before, but it was this feeling that everything was being upended, that all of these discussions were, you know, tearing families apart. And All in the Family not only showed how those discussions were happening, but also showed that it didn't necessarily have to tear a family apart. You could still love each other and think that your family member was an idiot. It was an interesting show to sort of contrast with that national mood at the time of, you know, our politics has completely gone off its rocker, which a lot of it was driven by Nixon himself.
Yeah, I was thinking, I mean, I could see Archie Bunker, you know, and the resentment he had towards everybody, and that may be kind of like the Nixon philosophy. But when I think of Nixon, I always think of this clip.
Sock it to me.
Right? Laughing, right?
Yeah. But the issue with that is, you know, again, by the rules of my game, which you are free to ignore if you like. Laughing really had its height during the Johnson years, and it was already on its way out once Nixon took office. But yeah, you got to associate Nixon with sock it to me. Incidentally, I love how he puts the emphasis on entirely the wrong word in that.
Well, who do you have for Johnson?
For Johnson, this is one that I'm a little less secure in, so if people take issue, that's fine. I picked the Andy Griffith Show. Part of the problem here is that television was in a fallow period during the Johnson years. It was not particularly good. This is right after Nell Minow's famous Vast Wasteland critique of the medium, and it really was living up to those words. But the Andy Griffith Show is a wonderful show, and its main character of Andy Taylor, the sheriff of Mayberry, kind of feels like a folksy spin on LBJ. It's entirely coincidental, but it really does. Those two guys really do feel like they're cut from the same cloth. LBJ, of course, was nowhere near as, you know, folksy and warm-hearted as Andy Taylor, but like you could sort of see them as the same character type, just going in completely different directions.
You know, I saw that you listed the Andy Griffith Show for Lyndon Johnson. I'm thinking, I don't know if I see it. And then I found this one scene that could very well be a metaphor for Vietnam. This comes after Don Knotts, who plays the deputy Barney Fife, I think it is. Yeah, he wants to know who threw a gum wrapper in the street. Listen to this.
All right, I'm going to count to 10, and then I want the man that threw that paper.
Oh, for Pete's sake, Barney, I did it. What's so terrible about that? Just a gum wrapper?
tell you what's so terrible about it. You start with gum wrappers, and then it's paper bags, then newspapers, and tin cans, and rubbish. First thing you know, Mayberry's up to here in litter. Now, litter brings slums, and slums brings crime. Now, is that what you want to see started here in Mayberry, a crime wave?
Todd, that's the domino theory in Vietnam, right?
Yeah, and that's the sneaky thing about Andy Griffith, is it talked about a lot of contemporary issues in the 60s through the lens of this very small town. So you would never hear like anybody on the Andy Griffith Show arguing about Vietnam, but they would argue about gum wrappers, and you would be like, yeah, I get what that means. So I think that that's one of the smart things about it, and sort of one of the reasons why I think it fits.
Very few people realize that throwing gum wrappers into the street would result in Vietnam.
Absolutely. That's how it happens.
Todd VanderWerf is the critic at large at Vox.com, and he's on Twitter at TVOTI. Todd, it was a lot of fun having you on the show.
Thank you so much.
It's time for This Week in Political History. It was an exciting week in the incredibly exciting political year of 2008. On Saturday, June 7th, Hillary Clinton formally ended her presidential campaign and endorsed the candidacy of Barack Obama, one of the most dramatic battles in recent Democratic presidential history. The next day, it was obviously the lead story on the top-rated Sunday morning news program, Meet the Press.
From NBC News in Washington, this is Meet the Press with Tim Russert.
Our issues this Sunday, it is over as Barack Obama proclaims victory.
I will be the Democratic nominee for the President of the United States of America.
And Hillary Clinton finally concedes.
Today, as I suspend my campaign.
And what was to follow? Would Obama ask Clinton to be his running mate, a team of rivals ticket? And what would John McCain, the all but official GOP nominee, respond with? And what would be Tim Russert's focus the following week? To that question, we will never know the answer. 9 years ago this week, on Friday, June 13th, yes, Friday the 13th, Tim Russert died of a massive heart attack. He was only 58 years old, just as history was about to be made in the battle for the White House. Anyone who cared about politics knew immediately how much of a loss Russert's death was. And with all that's going on these days, and with questions about the media, the fake media, sometimes I miss him more than ever. Betsy Fisher Martin spent 23 years at NBC News, nearly all of it at Meet the Press. She was the program's executive producer for 11 years. She and Russert made a great team. And she joins us now. Betsy, thanks so much for coming on The Political Junkie.
Oh, I am happy to join you. Thank you.
Well, I'm not going to presume to know what Tim would have said about the 2016 campaign, but I can't help but presume that, you know, we've all been cheated not having him on TV and sharing his observation. And I've been saying that for 9 years now. It just doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, and you know, you were playing that clip from 2008, and I vividly recall standing at the 2008 convention a couple months after Tim had passed away and standing out in Invesco Field when Obama, you know, accepted the nomination. I sort of had tears and chills because I just remember being so sad that he wasn't there, because we had spent that whole primary season on the road campaigning in this hard-fought primary, going to all the campaign events and doing shows on the road, and then sort of came to the end and he wasn't there. And I thought, wow, he would have loved to cover that general election, and certainly every election that's followed, you know, I've had a similar feeling.
Tell me how you guys met.
We met when I was an intern in college. I went to American University, and I decided my senior year before going to law school that I was going to do an internship at this show that I had vaguely heard of, Meet the Press. It was American University in Washington, D.C., and the NBC Washington Bureau was literally down the street from American University. I thought, this is a great internship. I can sleep late and, you know, I don't have to take the metro. I don't have to commute anywhere. I could just sleep late and walk to work. This is a great internship. And so that's what I did. And Tim Russert started as the moderator at almost the exact same time. And so we just had a great rapport together. And he asked me several months later when I was graduating to consider deferring my law school admission and staying and helping cover the campaign, doing research. And so that's what I did. And Tulane University still has my $700 deposit because I never went. But, you know, I was the researcher for a couple of years. And, you know, way back then in the Stone Age, there was no such thing as hopping on the computer and Googling, you know, a question or a research issue. I was the keeper of all of the information, and there is nothing Tim loved more than facts, right? So when I had the job of clipping newspapers and keeping files and doing briefing packets for him, and so I was a very valuable person in his eyes at that time because he wanted facts and I had them for him. So it was great job security.
But that was the greatness of Russert, the fact that he always had those facts at his fingertips, that nobody was ever able to get away with anything on his show because he knew what everybody said because of people like you and researchers who put that in front of him.
Exactly. And, you know, I remember, and this is commonplace now on television, you'll see a quote go up of somebody and a date and, you know, when they said X, Y, or Z. And that was sort of a novel approach back then. Tim would quote something back to the senator. Well, Senator, you seem to have changed your opinion. You know, 4 years ago, you said blah, blah, blah. And then the senator would naturally say, or the candidate, oh, no, Tim, I never said that. Tim would say, well, yes, you did. No, you didn't. And so we decided, well, we're just going to put this on a graphic, and we're going to put it on the screen. It'll have the quote, the attribution, the date, et cetera. And so that's really, we started doing that. And you see that a lot on television now. But back then, it was sort of a novelty to kind of put people's quotes up on the board. And Tim would say, well, let me put this up and, you know, put this on the board, he would say. And we started doing that. And then that sort of became his hallmark.
Do you have a favorite moment?
Oh, my goodness. I had 17 years with him every Sunday. Just so many fun things that we did. Covering conventions were always fun. Any sort of road show was fun with him. And, you know, he was a big sports fanatic, too. And I was not a big sports fan or knew nothing about sports. And all of a sudden, I'm producing a show with, you know, all-star basketball players. On a given Sunday from Cleveland. And so we would go and, you know, do road shows. We'll have Michael Jordan or Charles Barkley on to talk about values and you know, role models. And so just being put in those kind of different environments. And then invariably, you know, we get to go to the game too. So that was always fun.
And you had to be a Buffalo Bills fan, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I learned to cheer for the Bills early on.
Tim came from partisan Democratic politics. He worked for New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan and later Governor Mario Cuomo. But at least through my eyes, I never saw that he showed any favorites on Meet the Press. I thought he was notoriously tough on every politician, regardless of party. Here he is, tough on Hillary Clinton.
You voted to authorize war. The resolution you voted for, Robert Byrd said, was a blank check for George Bush. Ted Kennedy says was a vote for war. James Carville and Paul Begala said anyone who says that vote wasn't a vote for war is bunk.
Well, Tim, if I had a lot of paper in front of me, I could quote people who say something very differently. So I know you're very good at this, and I respect it.
Here he is, tough on Barack Obama.
When you announced your candidacy back in February of 07 in Springfield, the same place Abraham Lincoln announced his candidacy, and we're showing it there on the screen, Reverend Wright was going to give the invocation. He was disinvited. He told the New York Times that you said to him, quote, you get kind of rough in the sermons, so we decided it's best for you not to be out there in public. And you cited a Rolling Stone interview where he said that one of the essential facts about the U.S. is, quote, we believe in white supremacy and black inferiority and believe it more than we believe in God. Now, that is so contrary to a speech I heard you gave yesterday about one nation, one people.
Right.
So you knew in 07, this guy's a problem.
Right.
I have to keep him out of the spotlight involving my campaign.
Right.
Why didn't you just say then, you know, Reverend, we're going on different paths because this country does not believe in white supremacy and black inferiority?
You know, Betsy, when I looked at those videos the other day, it's not only listening to Tim and the fact that he had everything in front of him and all the facts at his fingertips, but the looks on both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama that they knew they were trapped. They knew they were that Tim was right.
Well, you know, listening to those clips, I mean, Tim had this sort of equal opportunity toughness about him that he really went out of his way to equally go after both sides. He frequently told a story when he first, you know, became the moderator of Meet the Press. He went to go visit Lawrence Spivak, who was one of the co-creators along with Martha Roundtree of Meet the Press back in 1947, if you can imagine. And Lawrence Spivak was still alive. Tim went to see him and asked him sort of what the secret of his success was. And he said, well, you learn as much about your guest as you can and you take the other side. And so he really tried to play kind of that devil's advocate, but do it in a way that was tough but fair and civil. He didn't like to get into petty politics. He'd like to talk about serious issues. And he took that very, very seriously. And he, you know, also his legal training was very helpful in that respect. He was never a practicing lawyer, but he did go to law school. And so he approached the questioning very much, you know, fact-based, asking question A to get to question B that would get you around to, you know, the zinger that you wanted in question C. He was very methodical about, you know, planning out a series of his questions. We would work for several days, and this is, you know, a lot of this was back when, you know, we would set the show on, you know, maybe a Tuesday or a Wednesday. We were not in this kind of 24/7, you know, the news changes overnight kind of situation that we are in today. And so we would have, you know, a good couple of days to really dig in and spend a lot of time kind of game playing out, you know, what those questions were going to be. The questions that he asked, you know, were not just off the top of his head. He had spent a lot of time really thinking about how to approach a particular question.
You know, I was smiling as you were just answering that. The thought of preparing a Sunday show on a Tuesday or a Wednesday.
Yeah, it was a luxury.
I mean, now it just seems impossible. Earlier we were playing tapes of how he put Democrats on their toes. Let me play something on Republicans, too. Here he is with John McCain.
Senator McCain, you have said repeatedly, quote, "I know a lot less about economics than I do about military and foreign policy issues. I still need to be educated." Is it a problem for your campaign that the economy is now the most important issue, one that, by your own acknowledgement, you are not well-versed on?
Actually, I don't know where you got that quote from. I'm very well-versed in economics.
Well, I know where you got that quote from. Now I know where you got that quote from.
I will show you where I got that quote from. I got it from John McCain.
And here he is with Vice President Dick Cheney.
The primary rationale given for the war in Iraq was Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. On August of 2002, this is what you told the VFW. Let's just watch it.
Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
In fact, there is grave doubt because they did not exist along the lines that you described, the president described, and others described.
Betsy, he just seemed like, not that he had no fear, but he just said, look, nobody's going to get away with anything on my program, and nobody seemed to.
Yeah, and you know, thinking about McCain and Cheney there, these are both people that had very tough interviews on Meet the Press. I mean, and as you say, Tim did not let them get away with anything, but they respected him, and they respected the process, and they respected this kind of notion of accountability. And they would come on Meet the Press very often because they knew that Tim was very prepared, that the interview was going to be fair, and they would have a chance to make their point, as opposed to a lot of what goes on now of, you know, screaming back and forth and, you know, people cutting each other off. Tim was always, you know, he would lay out the question and give the guest the opportunity to respond to it. And, you know, there was a funny quote that we played a lot from John McCain after one show. You know, Tim, you know, thanked him for coming. And John McCain, in his big smile, said, well, you know, thank you, Tim. I haven't had this much fun since my last interrogation. You know, referencing him being a POW in Vietnam. But so, you know, these guests, you know, had a healthy respect for journalism and for a platform where that they could explain their positions.
You know, some smiling, thinking of that John McCain story, and I do remember that. It reminds me, I'm going to play a piece of tape right now. Here he is with Bob Dole. This always made me laugh.
You've been on Meet the Press 63 times, which is more than anyone else in history. On this program, have you ever told the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Probably not.
That makes me laugh.
That was probably a very thought out question. I remember Tim had a follow up on there that was kind of the zinger. Well, let me ask you this. You know, this is always a leading up to something, you know, leading the witness, if you will.
You know, he always looked like he was having the time of his life and
he was
the job of his dreams, the job he was meant for. Where were you when you heard he died?
I was with him, actually, sadly enough. At the NBC Bureau. So it was, a horrible day.
How would you describe the legacy he left?
Oh, goodness. You know, I think he left a legacy of, you know, making people smarter, making people more informed, giving people an outlet to state their positions. He viewed his job as kind of a service. He really cared about people. He was not a cynic. He was smart in politics because he worked in politics, but he was never cynical, and he loved politics. He loved policy. And his enthusiasm for that, like you said, he looked like he was having the time of his life every Sunday because he was. I mean, that was real. And he just brought that to the show. And I think for, people that watched Meet the Press and that knew Tim, it was kind of a contagious enthusiasm, and you wanted to watch every Sunday.
Before we go, I want to play one more piece of tape. Here he is with an entrepreneur from New York in 1999 who was thinking of running for president.
Donald Trump, welcome to Meet the Press.
Well, thank you very much, Tim.
You are a registered Republican.
Correct.
There is a form that is being filed Monday, tomorrow, with the Board of Elections, which says what?
Well, it says that I am joining, as of Monday, the Reform Party, which in New York is the Independence Party, and I look forward to doing so.
Why are you joining the Reform Party?
Well, for one thing, I really believe the Republicans are just too crazy right. I mean, just what's going on is just nuts. And I'm seeing the Democrats as far too, Bradley and Gore are so liberal, it's just too liberal for me. And I really think they've hit a chord. They've hit a very good chord. And I guess I'm very popular in that party, and it certainly looks that way.
This will be read as a further indication that you are seriously thinking about running for president on the Reform Party.
Well, it may very well be.
Should it be?
I think so.
Betsy, you know, it's vintage Trump and it's vintage Tim.
Yeah, I mean, he calls it like he sees it, right, Tim? I mean, if you say something that is, you know, out of it, he will immediately jump right in. He was a great listener. You know, even though his questions were very prepared ahead of time, he was listening. And so he knew if you said something, you know, speaking of kind of fact-checking on the fly, if a guest said something that didn't quite add up, Tim would, you know, certainly come right back at them. He was very quick on that.
Betsy Fisher Martin spent 23 years at NBC News, 11 as executive producer of Meet the Press with Tim Russert. She's now executive in residence at the American University. I miss him, Betsy, and I'm sure you do, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Thank you so much for being on the program.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
It was 9 years ago this week, on June 13, 2008, that Tim Russert, the moderator of NBC's Meet the Press for 16 years, died of a heart attack at the age of 58. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
And I've got tea.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, or even a get well card, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Lose a wife, change my life, we're not together. A canceled future, well, it's hard on me.
you're gone, are you gone forever? Hope you love the baby I'm never gonna see. And I've got tears, in the morning. Just a one.